we unduly prejudice those that are presenting, because we want to skim through things. Let's start. To our members, we have, as you are aware, if you have the program, we're going to start with Agri-SA. And immediately after Agri-SA, we will get the African Farmers Association. And we'll get the banking perspective. And I'm assuming that they're all here, Mr. Pierre Fenter, and then Dr. Lisa, I know, is here, and then we'll get Hoshi, is here, and we will try and wrap them all up. So it's going to be a long session, honorable members. And when we start now, when we stop, we say Amen Sia Eval. So otherwise, we'll be here forever. So it's going to be a long session. But there's nothing we can do about it if we want to do justice to our program. It is, 1 o'clock exactly? So you've got until 1:15, and I'll warn you that you've got 5 minutes late. At 1:20, you will stop. Okay, over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members, thank you for the opportunity to present. And for the invitation, I represent Agri-SA. I'm a farmer, a cattle farmer from the Northeastern Free State, and I apologize for Annelies Crosby, who could not be here today, so for my sins I will have to stand in for her. Agri-SA, you probably all know who Agri-SA is and who we represent. A huge organization, almost 70 organizations strong, 9 provinces, 25 commodity organizations, and 32 corporates. And we represent farmers of all shapes and sizes and color. We're not an Afrikaans organization. We're not a cultural organization. We're an agricultural organization representing the interests of farmers. Our stance on land reform is well documented over time. We are supportive of an orderly process, a legal process, and sustainable agriculture is what we stand for. Maybe the bottom bullet there is not something that people would associate with Agri-SA. We understand the moral argument, Chairperson. I recently read a book on the 1913 Land Act to acquaint myself on that. And the simple fact is this: by 1913, 70% of the population, which were black, lived on 7% of the land. And then we had the 1913 Land Act, and then we had apartheid, and this is where we are now, and that now we have to undo all this. So we understand the moral argument, and we do not shy away from it, and we are huge role players in rectifying the wrongs of the past. So, information on Agri-SA stance, I'll pick up on the third bullet. We align ourselves with Chapter 6 of the NDP. In 2014 at our Congress, we adopted a holistic plan for land reform, and we followed that up by a finance model, and I will speak to finance a little bit later on, which is absolutely crucial. And then we don't just conjure up plans, we actually implement them. That picture that you see there on the left is our transformation report that came out of about a month ago, and that is just our affiliates, our commodity organizations spend almost 331 million on supporting emerging farmers across all those commodities. Maybe just one example there. A lot has been said about the poverty in the former homelands. And that is true. One of the examples that you will find in that transformation report is the help being given to the wool farmers in the former Transkei. And in 1994, somewhere they produced 1.5 million rands worth of wool. Now they produce 350 million rands worth of wool, 13% of the national clip. So that is serious poverty alleviation and rural development in our opinion, and we can do so much more, and we want to. Our stance on the Constitution, there you have it. It's both a guarantee of existing and future property rights and an instruction to rectify the skewed ownership and tenure patterns of the past. I think we don't need more policies. I think we need to implement. We had a plethora of policies over the last couple of years, and I think we don't need more plans and policies. We need to start implementing. And Chairperson, I would strongly argue it is our inability to cooperate as South Africans that is keeping us from making far greater process in progress in terms of land reform. So, and just the bottom one, I'm not going to go into all the legal issues again, but changing Section 25 of the Constitution is not going to fix our problems. It'll in effect land us with a whole heap of other problems that we will have to face. What are the reasons? I'm not going to go into this. A lot of has been said about that this morning. We support the high-level panel report of former President Galema Motlanthe, and there you can see the reasons why we have not made sufficient progress in land reform. And a lot of the speakers this morning have already referred to that, so I won't go through that. But if those are the problems, let's rather rectify those instead of changing the constitution, creating more problems for ourselves. There are two more reports that the honourable members can read that will speak to not implementing inadequate budgeting, poor implementation, and irregular spending. And then the bottom bullet is the one that I would like to focus on. I believe, Chairperson, that we are going the wrong way with property rights in this country. We should go the other way. We should strengthen property rights. And we argue heavily that the beneficiaries of a land reform should have full title. It unlocks, that in our opinion will be the biggest empowerment exercise this country has ever seen, because you will give them property rights, you will unlock finance. Why should emerging farmers not have the same rights as all other South Africans? So we argue very strongly for that. International and comparative law perspective, I'm not going to go into the law that deeply. I think in the middle, the third bullet just says that you cannot expect of commercial farmers or any farmer to bear the brunt as an individual for something that that is in the national interest, and therefore compensation should be paid. And I'm not going any deeper into that argument. We have never attempted in South Africa to change a fundamental human right, and I don't believe that we should do so now. And we will be out of step with the international community. This is just some more international and comparative law perspectives. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a cattle farmer. And one of my colleagues here, Ernest Pringle from the Eastern Cape, is a lawyer, so if there are any questions on this slide later on, but it's just to say that different countries do it differently. If somebody would like to ask a question on what the differences there are, maybe Ernest, you hopefully studied them. Chairperson, let's go into statistics, and I don't want to make a huge issue of this. The state land audit has been released last year. It has come in for a fair bit of criticism. While it has come in for criticism, everybody is still quoting it, and that is problematic. And let me go to the next slide, and that is that AgriSA also attempted a land audit, and we've been extremely humble when we did that, Chairperson. Our land audit is also not perfect, but it was an honest attempt to bring figures to the table. We have come in from criticism from some of the speakers here this morning and from AFASA, and where a perception was created that it was racist or anything of that nature, I apologized personally, because that was not the intention of the audit. The audit was to bring figures, because if we do not know where we were in 1994 and what we have done ever since and what the trends are and how much progress we made, how would we then know from where we are now in the medium term? Because this problem is not going to be solved in the short term. You're not going to you're not going to undo the structural damage of apartheid that stretched over 50, 60, 70, 80 years and taking it back even further. You're not going to rectify that just like that. And that's the balance that we all seeking for. So there are some figures. Our figures say 73.3% of land is still in the hands of white commercial farmers. I just go one step back, and it's not in the slides. I was the president of Free State Agriculture when we did our land audit. So Kwanalu, Sandy sitting over there, they were first, and Free State Agriculture did our land audit. And the point I want to make, Chairperson, is we got considerable help in the Free State from Department of Rural Development. If it was not for them and their technical expertise, we could not have finalized that audit. So this is the message from the audits that we have. We need collaboration from the technical people who did all these audits so that we end up sort of on the same page and then say, how do we plan forward? If we do not do that, everybody will still be quoting their own stats. I'm sure that is necessarily helpful. I'm going to skip this slide. You can go and read it at your own leisure. I want to dwell a little bit on this slide. First of all, I want to say, let's give credit where credit is due. The government did not do nothing. They bought a whole lot of land. Whether it was enough or not, that's not the issue. They did a lot. It is, in our opinion, the fact that the beneficiaries did not receive title, which is a part of why they were not successful. 2.8 million hectares were bought, 3.2 million for restitution, and then the interesting one, Chair, 4.2 million hectares bought by black people without any government assistance. That is in the free market. So a lot of people say we must move away from the market, and the market market mechanisms does not have a place anymore. Nothing could be further from the truth. We must go and investigate how did 4.2 million hectares, how was it bought by people of color in the open market, and how can we going forward make it easier for them to keep on buying it. So the market is still there, it is functioning, it must be one of the methods that we use to make progress. And then you have the figures there, Chair. We went to the deeds office and I don't know how many thousands of transactions were researched, and our research showed that government did not pay a premium. There were corruption in many instances, and many times it didn't take two to tango, it took three to tango. There were private sector corruption as well, because it takes a few people to tango. But government, according to our figures, did not pay a premium, and in fact the private sector transactions paid more than government. So those figures are all there. I believe we should interrogate them, Chair, and like I said, we need to put all the audits together to give us a picture of where we are and where we need to go. And AgriSA is extremely humble in this regard, and we will give our cooperation. They are just some of the pictures coming out of our land audit, and according to our audit and the way that it was compiled, some of the provinces are in excess of 50% black-owned. The problem, the slide was previously put up where the poverty is. That land is not being capitalized. And that is where finance and property rights and in communal land, some form of rights that can be financed. If we can do that, like we do with the wool farmers, etc., we can make great progress in terms of poverty alleviation. Chair, I'm not going to go and make a huge economic argument of what would happen to the country if we would go expropriation without compensation, because I simply don't believe that we as a country are going to go that extreme route. I honestly, AgriSA has maintained that position, so we are not alarmist, but we have to take into account our population will rise in future, and if agricultural production does not keep up, you know, we had load shedding, heaven forbid we have food shedding. We have not seen that. There are poor people that cannot buy food and cannot afford food, but we are still food secure. We still export more than we import. The second part of the ANC's resolution is critical, that we increase agricultural production, economic growth, etc. Without that, we are in trouble as a country. The slide on the agricultural debt, maybe Pierre Venter from Basel will elaborate on this in his presentation. Why do farmers have that amount of debt, 160 billion against an asset base of 450 billion? It is because they expand their businesses, they invest in production. Why do they invest, Jay? Because they expect in a country where you have policy certainty that you will get a return on your investment. That's the only way they do it. And in my humble opinion, the uncertainty levels now in the country is far too high. We need to sort this issue out as South Africans. If the uncertainty levels that we have now amongst the farming community, you know, keeps on like it is now or goes further, that is not a good thing. That amount of debt, how do we farm? We leverage the debt against the value of the land, and if the value of the land goes down or stabilizes in this process, agricultural finance will be affected. One last comment on this. This is only the farming picture, or the agricultural sector. We must understand that agriculture is far bigger. You've got a before the farm gate and after the farm gate. They say that the agro-industrial complex in this country represents 20% of the economy. So when we get this right, that would be a huge positive. If we get this whole debate wrong, we will affect almost 20%, or we could affect 20% of the economy. That is how crucial it is. It's far bigger than the numbers that I quote here. Just the last one on food security. We had a taste, Chair, 2 years ago with the drought. We did not have enough maize as a staple food. We went from export parity prices to import parity, 5,000 rand a ton. And if the rand-dollar exchange rate would, if that would become the norm and the rand-dollar exchange rate would turn against us, we will have serious problems with food prices, instability, etc. So food security, absolutely critical that part of the ANC resolution gets the necessary attention. That's the point of this slide. What do we then, basically two slides from the end, Chair. AgriSA's plans for sustainable land reform and rural development. In our holistic plan, we covered a whole range of issues. And I want to stress the point, there's not a one silver bullet that we would need to do. In my opinion, expropriation would be the last resort because there are so many better options. We really have better alternatives if we cooperate as South Africans. And if we have cooperated and have a good look at these plans, we can make progress. So what did we deal with in that holistic plan? Sustainable restitution models. Sandy is sitting over there has considerable experience in that. Support for farmers in communal areas. I've spoken about the rural farmers just as one example. A social compact. We need to take care of our farm workers. We need to create a safe environment for people and a secure environment for people to work on farms and in the agricultural sector. Promotion of partnerships. We are heavily in favor of partnerships. Chair, there are some beautiful examples coming out of commercial farmers partnering with their farm workers, with black partners, and if we can unlock the finance mechanism, which is basically subsidized interest rates and favorable conditions, farmers would actually... I get so many phone calls from farmers asking me, how do I get involved? Where do I get the finance? How do I do this? Because I want to do this. It's not for a lack of commitment. So partnerships, absolutely key going forward. Public-private partnership for implementation. That's the one on the left. That is just basically all of us working together, government with a guarantee, the private sector, we take hands, we implement properly. We have not done that in the past. And then one chair that hasn't received a lot of attention, AgriSA has put forward right of first refusal to government in 2014 already. For some reason, it is not looked at, but we have put that forward. And then viable, affordable finance for new farmers. Hopefully, Pierre will speak to that, because that is absolutely key. Che, if they don't have property rights, how do we expect emerging farmers to access the finance that I can access having property rights? So I'm arguing heavily for that. Those are the plans that we propose: finalize the expropriation bill, test the expropriation powers contained in the Constitution, get consensus on the audit figures, I've spoken on that in depth, implement the high-level panel recommendations, well-situated state-owned land needs to be made available for housing for the poor, land framework law should be passed as proposed by the high-level panel, create an office for an ombudsman. This is something that came from AFASA, and Dr. Vuyo Mhlathi will present just after me. We support AFASA in that one. Hopefully she will elaborate on that. Proper monitoring and evaluation, appropriate financing mechanisms, and we believe, Chair, that the plans, I said we don't need more plans. We have the National Development Plan, we have Operation Pakisa, and we have the Constitution that can guide us. We should start implementing and working together. Last slide, Chair. We do not believe the Constitution need to be changed. We need to deal with the real impediments to land reform. AgriSA wants to be a part of this. We are a willing and able partner. I believe, Chair, in closing, that there is a deficit of trust that we need to work on. And hopefully in my presentation people can gather that AgriSA is a changed organization than what it was in the past, or what people perceive it to be. And we are heavily solution driven. We will be a part of the solution. We will and want to help to implement. We will support emerging farmers. We want to expand on that. And I actually believe that all of this in the medium term is very much doable. It is easily doable. Land reform is not rocket science. And if you involve and trust us as the commercial sector, we want to be a part of the solution. Thank you, Jane.
Very thank you, Meneer. Dr. Mhlathi.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity. I stand here if I get my presentation at some point, representing I stand here representing the African Farmers Association of South Africa, AFASA. And we really are very privileged to be presenting, but also appreciating the fact that this is not an AFASA submission. We will be sort of, our submission is basically dealing broader with issues and more specific, but what we thought we would do with this presentation was just to highlight some critical aspects that inform the perspective of AFASA. What we did, Chair, as AFASA, which is an organization of... Here it is, what we did was a presentation to make sure that, to go through different, we have farmers across the country, close to 300,000 that are members, and basically we have farmers who are subsistence farmers in communal, as well as all the way to commercial farmers. They're in communal areas. There are also farmers who are beneficiaries of some of the state's programs. So ours today is just to highlight, you know, the approach and perspectives and the rationale or context thereof, being very mindful of the time. I just put the slides as far as the audit, and I'm glad that my colleague from AgriSA referred to that, because from our side, we've looked at all the audits from government as well as from the AgriSA, and have raised issues with both. To a greater extent, we believe that the government one needs more work done in terms of unpacking, particularly the trusts and the corporates, that, you know, we're not clear about the ownership, because the picture will emerge and evolve further once that is clarified. But according to the record at this point, it has become difficult for them to do that. The other issue that would have preferred to understand further are issues related to gender. Although in some of the work it is sort of presented, but it's not satisfactory. But this is something that we're following up directly with the department at this point. But the point is, it doesn't matter which picture you look at. It's very clear that as far as issues of race, black people generally, and women have really had a raw deal as far as this is concerned. So our premise basically starts from that. The other issue that I'd like to deal with without spending more time on, because this is focusing on Section 25, so I'd rather focus attention more on that. The issue of land reform failures, as far as government is concerned to a greater extent, is something that we recognize, and we specifically pay attention to the approaches that we use the government, the premise of the market failure, and also the understanding that the Constitution does not prescribe the willing buyer, willing seller, but as an approach that has been used by government has not managed to give us the result we're looking for. And the fact that from a redistribution perspective, the one farm by one farm, you know, approach in terms of buying commercial farms has been a total disaster. And we feel that it has basically perpetuated the result of generally marginal land being acquired, but at a different level. It's not strategic, and I'll refer to that later, and it's at the center of our proposal for expropriation without compensation. And our other areas refer to the highly inflated prices, and these are issues that we've also checked with the financial institutions. The land bank, will confirm that, hopefully, but they have confirmed it at institutional level, because we've presented cases to them. We've tracked it as a FASA across the board in terms of certain farms that would be sold from white farmer to white farmer, or from white farmer to government, or white farmer to black. We've seen even those discrepancies. So part of this basically is it just shows that there is a problem across the board. A central part of it is corruption. And it's this corruption that is within government very strongly, and also with the private sector, and across the whole chain, from farmers to FHAs, property valuers, and as indicated, with the government officials. And we've also seen farmers from the black side who have colluded with the system, and what we call those who masquerade as farmers but are not necessarily farmers. But the state capacity is a big issue, the poor state capacity, and it's the institutional support and the reform which we believe needs to be part of that. At the center of this is the poor capacity that ends up being a problem for the black farmer generally. And this we attribute to the liberalization of the agriculture, the whole deregulation 20 years ago, which I will refer to later on. But for us, we believe that it is imperative that we consider the expropriation without compensation. And we say that because we believe it is important to speed up land reform. At the center, we say when you are dealing with a situation of dispossession, when you are dealing with legislated land invasions from the previous regimes of colonialism and apartheid, you cannot just address them by hoping that somebody will knock at the door and say, I am willingly giving you this farm. You need to have a strategic approach because this is not just about a particular farm. It is about industrial transformation. Ours is to ensure that when we deal with land reform, we align it with agrarian reform. And the approach that we're taking is actually not assisting in that form. So the goals that we push as far as the proposals that I'm going to just quickly unpack are basically ensuring that we centralize the land reform program, which includes the amendments or new legislation as far as the expropriation without compensation, with the goal of transformative comprehensive land resettlement plan for socioeconomic and sustainable development. So it is not just a haphazard approach. The second approach is the goal of food security restoration. The restoration of food security is a critical thing. As much as we agree with the resolution, particularly of the ruling party, of expropriation without compensation, and also the area of food security, we are very clear from our side that this is not about perpetuating the current status quo as far as food security is concerned, because what we are dealing with now is food insecurity of the majority of black people. And secondly, as far as food production, we're dealing with very limited participation of black farmers, but at a commercial level as far as food production is concerned. So the food production picture that we are talking about is highly not inclusive. So what we're talking about is inclusive growth with inclusive food production and a value chain approach. So we are not supporting just willy-nilly perpetuating the status quo. And aligned to that is alignment of land reform with agrarian reform. At the center of our proposals, specifically looking as far as land reform, we're coming up with very clear proposals where we talk about an amendment which is transformative. We have listened to proposals that talk to, we've looked at the public works bill, which was looking at expropriation, including without compensation. Our concern was that it does not specify the public interest part. And we believe that it has to be clear from an agricultural land for agriculture that we specify that very clearly. Our second issue is that the interpretation currently, and we've analyzed cases that have gone to court, and we worry that if we do not address very specifically constitutional amendments, and as the questions that were asked earlier, we are going to find ourselves, particularly people who don't have the resources, losing cases because people with money don't mind staying in constitutional courts forever until they win the case. And in this case, we would not want to leave it to interpretations across the board. We want clarity. And we believe this process gives us the opportunity to be extremely clear in terms of the conditions for expropriation without compensation. So one of the things, for instance, that we have looked at is to look in terms of a redistribution, which is very focused. And if you take, for instance, the case of the acquisition of particularly white commercial farms, because I'm specifically mentioning this because our view, Chair, is that part of the spatial inequity is being perpetuated through land acquisition. And we're sitting now with 17 million hectares that have been acquired by government, and 14 million hectares of that being from former homelands. And we believe that you cannot, even though we're pushing, and these are the, when we talk about lack of titles, the bulk of what we're talking about is our land titles of this land in majority former homeland areas. And we're saying you cannot say black people must just have titles in their former homelands. You are perpetuating the status quo. We need to make sure that we are shifting. If we are presented with the statistics of over 70% of the land, commercial land in white commercial farmers individually, then this is something that we are needing to address. And very systematically, no invasions and basically harassment of people. It's a strategic approach, and this strategic approach for us, we propose an area-based focus that analyzes the agri-ecological value of the land and begins to look at the potential from a commodity or agricultural subsector perspective. And this will begin to address very systematically at a local level, where local municipalities, together with provinces as national, giving powers to the president to be able to expropriate without compensation where necessary. And this, we believe, will assist in addressing food security. It will also assist in improving the participation of blacks who have been excluded and women and youth included in a very systematic approach that is supported with post-settlement support. So part of this, the process has unpacked to us that we have the gaps in terms of legislation and policies, and previous presenters have dealt with that. So we also realize that we are still using the apartheid legislation, which includes the provision of the Land and Assistance Act 126 of 1993, and other people referred to other pieces of legislation. So the absence of legislation dealing specifically with expropriation of agricultural land is something we believe needs to be addressed. And also, whilst we refer to the NDP, which talks to what I was presenting as far as an area-based, district-based approaches, the problem is that the NDP is a voluntary, you know, a framework. It is not legislated. So in a sense, it becomes important for us to strengthen these. One of the things that we have found to be important is the emphasis on the productive capacity of the land. Because it is not that black people just want land for the sake of land. It's important for us to be clear as far as where we're focusing. We have seen the strength, and I've been very fortunate to have participated in some of the restitution areas, the Dwese Kwebe, Mkambati, Makuleke, Rachtersveld, and other cases. And one has an appreciation of what one goes through and communities go through when we deal with that. And we say it's important to make sure that that support is provided adequately. Otherwise, we say the processes have failed. Another important thing, Chair, as part of the transformative comprehensive approach, is to make sure that the current programs that are not working are actually phased out. We have looked at the recaps, the pluses, 50-50 in terms of some of the equity schemes, and we have specific proposals. You know, there are issues of governance, but generally there's a conceptualization problem which stems from a need to relook at how we address these issues. Finance is a big issue. The issue of title deeds is a big issue that affects finance. But at another level, you see, when we talk to the finance institutions, we actually remind them that one of the reasons they panic when we talk about expropriation without compensation is because they know that over 90% of their clients are white commercial farmers. They absolutely have no, very limited interest in terms of what they're invested in black farmers. And hence we are saying that we need a different conversation around that. Land Bank, they're going to be presenting that here, and we've raised it directly with them, that they have the mandate as far as land reform is concerned. But we sit with a situation where 90% and over of what the land bank loan book is about is mainly strengthening white commercial farmers. And where land bank has rightfully looked at working with public-private partnerships, with commodity associations, with established agribusinesses, as channels for lending. Unfortunately, that method has not worked because those channels continued to strengthen white commercial farmers. So we sit with a situation now where we are needing to relook at what we do as far as financing, because more and more black farmers have no hope as far as financial institutions are concerned, particularly the commercial banks. So, Chair, what we are saying from our side is that the food security is a priority, as I conclude. The whole area of land allocation, if you are going to give third-grade land and marginal land, you cannot expect to get food security. And also, we have seen that former homelands are densely populated. It is not going to be expected, and we know the problems. We are going to have our own discussions with the traditional leaders. We will continue to have them because there are serious issues from a gender and youth perspective as far as some of the customary practices are concerned. But another central issue is the area of concentration from a food production perspective to few white farmers. The Competition Commission, we're working with them. This is an area that they are very seized with, and they've looked at high concentration in grain storage and processing and from a trading perspective. And we believe that these are issues that need to be looked at. And finally, we believe that at the center of this, the failure, and when we are going to focus on expropriation without compensation, we need to ensure that alignment of land reform with agrarian reform. This slide shows how over time government spending on agriculture from 1910 to 2011 in the slide, and it continues to slide down, that basically we've seen 1930s to 48, serious investment by government on farmers. And right now, that has reduced at a time, and with the deregulation around 1997, we're finding ourselves less and less with in terms of the spending. And with the privatization of institutions that were previously state-owned, how black farmers have lost. So, in conclusion, ours is specifically looking at ensuring that we get an ombudsperson that will, beyond what we're coming up with now, the proposal of supporting the expropriation without compensation, protect the farm dwellers and labor tenants, protect the injustices that subsistence and emerging farmers, as well as commercial farmers, continuously experience in the hands of white commercial farmers, in the hands of governments from local to national. And we believe that it is something that has to be done if we have interest in the protection of rights of the vulnerable. And we are very happy, Chair, we are just coming, Afasa, from Russia, from the World Farmers Organization. And it was at the World Farmers Organization that AgriSA presented support for world farmers against expropriation. And we, as AFASA, stood up and made a statement that this is a national process. We are comfortable that all of us as farmers, in our different views, have space in terms of a participatory process in South Africa. We are grateful that the majority of the world farmers supported and voted in our favor. So we are grateful that this process continues for all of us. Thank you.
Siyabonga, Dr. Mr. Pierre Fenter from Banking Association South Africa. 5 past will be your absolute last time, so pace yourself accordingly. I will remind you at the top of the hour, but by 5 past I will stop you. Good afternoon, Chair. Our apologies for the delay. Good afternoon to the MPs. If I may, first of all, tender Kaz Kavadia's apologies. He can't be here today. He's actually part of the presidential delegation to the G7 at the moment, so you're going to have to put up with me, I'm afraid. The position that I'm presenting this afternoon is not the mandated. Sure.
The position I'm presenting today, Chair, is not the finalised banking sector position. The matter, our detailed submission is currently before our board, and we will have it with you before the 15th. Who are we? We are the industry body that represents all commercial banks in South Africa. That's banks registered in terms of the Banks Act. We have 35 members, both South African and international banks. What do we seek to achieve as an association? We forge partnerships with relevant stakeholders to influence an environment in which banks can do profitable business in a way that promotes international best practice, transformation, and sustainable socio-economic growth and development. Our position, we're fully supportive of the state's initiatives to rectify past injustices and to correct land ownership patterns. We think that this is essential for South Africa's sustainability. I think the big challenge that is ahead of us, though, is how do we make it work for the poor of our country and that it doesn't actually increase their plight. As a sector, we remain committed to playing a leading role in working with key beneficiaries, including government, to find an all-inclusive solutions to both this and other economic challenges so as to create a better life for all South Africans. Later on in the presentation, I'll talk to some of the financing initiatives that we've tried to get going to actually achieve this redress. We do, however, believe that a land reform must happen in an orderly manner. If it doesn't, what it does do is it undermines our security for loans, which is property. And if you look at that picture there, you will see that there's something like close on 1.6 trillion rands worth of assets that we've lent money against in respect of property. About 133 billion of that is to the agricultural market, a further billion to the residential market, and then the commercial and industrial market close on 400 million. Why we put up the total exposure is that we do believe that property is about long-term investor confidence, and that one needs to make sure that if one puts forward a land reform position, that it doesn't dilute property rights in the other sectors, which is not the initial intention, but we will get into that a little bit later on. One of our big problems is the fact that we value our assets, and that includes property at market value, and this is based on the Banks Act, which is what regulates the banking sector in this country. And the Banks Act in this country is aligned to a global regulatory framework called Basel. South Africa is a member of the G20, and so we're obliged as a country to implement whatever is promoted by Basel in terms of global regulatory frameworks. If there is a marked decrease in the value of properties, either due to amended legislation or market uncertainty, one of the big issues we could face as a sector is that it could destabilize our sector, and this would have an impact not only on ourselves but also on the country's ratings, and I will talk to that in a couple of minutes. From a legislative perspective, and there were a number of eminent speakers that spoke this morning, I think we're of the same view that there's no need to change the constitution. We think that the tools are there, but that politics, patronage, corruption and government paralysis or lack of prioritisation has been responsible for the poor progress in land reform. We also, and some of our earlier speakers spoke to it, suggest that we need an independent body to ensure fairness and to ensure that equity remains at the forefront of land reform and land expropriation. Touching on the social implications and economic and social implications, I think the first item that I wish to draw to the attention of everyone is the importance of the agricultural sector, the number of people it employs, its ability to create additional employment, and there I wish to highlight that for every million rand put into capital invested into the sector would create an additional 4.5 million jobs. And if you look at our NDP, it talks about the agricultural sector creating an additional 1 million jobs within the sector. Food security, these are figures produced by Stats SA. The latest figures that I've seen from them is that
11.8% of our population is now experiencing hunger. It's no longer the 5.9% that is there before you. And it's therefore critical that we actually maintain and increase production levels as our population grows. For us, for our agricultural sector to deal with this, it needs to invest into capital. I think as climate changes on us and as the agricultural world is changing and we live in a global village, the need for capital investment to adjust and for South Africa to be competitive is vital. What is of concern is that despite what Dan says about the farmers investing into their properties, the picture we have is that what we are seeing, and if you look at that red bar there, that's the increase in debt to the, within the farming sector of the last 6 or 7 years. But if you look at the blue line, it actually, and you compare the green line, which is the capital in investment versus the debt, what we are seeing is that farmers are actually not investing aggressively enough in terms of trying to retain their long-term competitiveness, and that blue line is of concern because ultimately what it will do within the next decade or so is result in a position where our farmers are not globally competitive, and of course our food prices will rise. I want to spend a little bit of time on these next two slides because I think that's why you're here today, to actually understand the impact that or that expropriation without compensation would have on the banking sector and the country. This is a summary of a much larger piece of work that we've done in our submission, Chair, which will broaden a lot of what I'm going to say this afternoon. But I think the shock of expropriation without compensation, what would happen if this were to happen in our country? I think the first thing you've got is your direct cost, and you saw the little bar graph that I put together about the exposure that we have to property in this country. So you'd have a lot of debt write-off in that area, high level of impairments, in other words, arrears. What would happen from an investor perspective is that their perceptions of property as a Class A form of security would reduce, and they would start looking to disinvest from property in South Africa for three reasons. Why? Potential losses that they may experience at a future date because of expropriation without compensation. They don't want to be exposed to a property market where property prices are falling as people are looking to disinvest from it, and then of course it elevates the risk and it lowers the return that they get, so it actually undermines the asset, property as an asset to investors. So what would happen then? Your concerns would trigger a low demand for property and mortgages in general. Obviously, what your commercial banks do as they lend depositors money is they would react to this, and they would adopt a more cautionary approach to lending to property, which would be in the form of tight lending criteria, which would inhibit access to finance. The outcome from that would be falling property prices, and then if you look at the secondary indirect impact, you'd have slower growth or shrinking mortgages, lower collateral values, pressure on banking profits and rising capital requirements. Now, I want to talk a little bit about that in the next slide, because it's not just the banking sector that will be affected by it, it's actually the country. So if you look at a generic balance sheet of the South African Bank, on the left-hand side, you've got the assets, and on the right-hand side is the equity and liability, the assets being the loans that a bank would give out. The impact on the asset side of the balance sheet, that obviously property values would be hurt, so the impacts on our collateral. So what you would have is a reduction in property prices, which I've described just now. What would then happen is your impairments would go up or your arrears would go up and the losses would be experienced. Now, what that does is it because you've got a weakened asset with dropping prices, it increases the risk of those assets. So your loan to property value goes up. and the equity that, that households have in that property are lessened. So because it's riskier, what would then happen is from a regulatory perspective, a bank would be required to hold more capital in support of those assets. This could result in a loss in confidence in the banking sector, and that's both from a local and international investor perspective, and I'll talk a little bit about that on the liability side just now, and also in the country's rating, sovereign rating. And that would in turn trigger further sovereign ratings downgrades with implications for the liability side of both the balance sheets of commercial banks and our country. As if you look at the right-hand side, which is the equity and liabilities, as banks, we place reliance on wholesale funding for about 32.7% or 1.7 trillion as our source of funds to make that money available in the market. And that comes from both local and foreign investors or bonds that are actually granted to the banking sector. What you would find is that because the risk has increased substantially on that, two things would happen. From an international perspective, what they would probably do is sit on the fence for a while. If South Africa and the banking sector got a downgrade to junk bond status, the reality is we've got two of our three rating agencies at the moment that have got us in junk bond status. We've got Moody's with us one grade above junk bond status. But if you get to junk bond status, you have a global bond index, which is a Citibank global bond index, and international asset managers are required to withdraw all their lendings to South Africa. You're not allowed to invest people's pensions and whatnot into countries which are in junk bond status. So that money would immediately take flight from South Africa. From a local perspective, because we are deemed to be a riskier sector than other sectors within the economy, our local asset managers would start either looking for a higher return on their money, or they would look to put their money elsewhere. And of course, as I said just now, you know, there's a higher reliance of 32.7% on that funding for us to actually make those loans available to the public. So our balance sheet would constrict. What we would find is that the securitization system, which is where the banks actually take the assets that they've actually lent money against and they actually move it into the long-term asset managers area, they sell it, that avenue would be actually closed to us. So what would happen is that you're talking about 368 billion rands worth of money that's sitting in the cyclical position that I've described is now all being placed at risk. Just from a security of tenure perspective, and there's been lots of commentary about it earlier on, but for us the sadness around lack of security of tenure is that families are unable to create generational wealth. They've limited access to finance and they're excluded from the formal economy. And somehow we really need to address it because as a collective, outside of rural areas, if you add the urban dilemma to that, you're almost looking at about 40% of your population. We will be making a number of recommendations. I'm not going to go into it now, Chair. Land restitution, and we heard about its failure this morning. You know, I think it reflects an untenable position for both parties. First of all, from a claimant's perspective, it's really socially injustice. Can you imagine having to wait 500 years for your claim to be resolved? And then from a landowner's perspective, what happens is it sterilizes the property. They won't invest into that property because their tenure is insecure. They recognize that it's going to be taken away from them, and that obviously impacts negatively on production. They're also unable to sell it because nobody wants to buy a property that's under land claim. From a land distribution perspective, and these slides were presented there this morning around why land restitution is not faring as well as it should. I would just like to make one extra comment, and that is to say that we partnered with the Agricultural Business Chamber. Now, the Agricultural Business Chamber has got the cooperatives, which is, for instance, your AFGRIs and SENVESs and whatnot of this world, are their members. We partnered with them to actually create financing models, a financing model with the Department of Rural Development, and that goes back to 2015. Our model was premised on a partnership. It was premised on and aligned to the National Development Plan, Operation Pukisa, and so on. It never got off the ground, presumably because of an unfunded mandate. But the calculations that we've done reflects that at 5.3 million farms would have been transferred from white ownership to black ownership since 2015. We're also talking to the Department of Agriculture at the moment to see how we can get a partnership going in terms of on-farm financing. Just some further comments. First of all, we think that residential and rural land is interwoven. Those are just a word of caution around a broad stroke around so-called speculative and land purchase in peri-urban areas but for investment purposes. A lot of that could well be developers who are buying agricultural land up with a view to developing it and are going through a process. So one would just need to be a little bit circumspect about which land you target has been vacant and unproductive in an urban perspective. Whilst the focus is on legislation and policy reform, there's a pressing need for a review of human settlements policy in our country. What we've seen is housing backlogs double since 1994. The 300 informal settlements we had then are now sitting at 2,700. And if you look at the every year that goes by, there's an additional 100,000 plus families that are homeless because our policy is unable to meet to that demand. We've made a lot of commentary in our submission around land and what needs to be done from both an agricultural perspective, a residential perspective, and a commercial and industrial perspective. We'll also be proposing a number of state and market-led initiatives to effect meaningful land reform and transformation. We have studied the Brazilian position over the last 30 years, and they've made a lot of headway both in terms of becoming an agricultural powerhouse in our world, but also as far as land reform, and it may well help guide the committee in terms of what it is we should be doing. But I think the key message from Brazil is that the state prioritized agriculture and land reform as its top priority. Agriculture was seen as the top economic driver for that country, and if we don't put our muscle behind land reform and agrarian development, this is where I agree with the Fossey, you can't separate out the two, they need to be brought together, we will not achieve the success we hope to achieve out of this. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, sir. Can we have the land bank, and immediately after the land bank we will have Jose. I will warn you at 25 minutes past, and I'll stop you at half past.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, members, and thank you for the opportunity to contribute to this debate. I think I would like to observe that my previous, the two previous speakers touched on a few points that have a direct bearing on the land bank's own thinking about the subject of land reform. The land bank's perspective is that, of course, land reform is the current land reform debate is inevitable. It's an inevitable national discussion, and we are actually pleased with the renewed impetus and the energy that is being directed towards addressing the issue of land reform in the country. If you look at where the land bank derives its mandate, the Land Bank Act as amended in 2002, you will see why it goes without saying that for us this is an issue that is of critical importance. The objects of the Land Bank Act, as I have put them up there, are very clear. Equitable ownership of agricultural land, in particular increasing ownership of agricultural land by HDIs, agrarian reform, land access for agricultural purposes. You can see all of these. My previous colleagues touched on them. Agricultural entrepreneurship, removal of the legacy of racial, gender, and racial and gender discrimination in agriculture, enhancing productivity, growth, etc. So it's not just growth of the agricultural sector that we're concerned with. There is a very strong transformative role that the bank is expected to play. And therefore, the issue of land reform is right at the core of the work that the institution is concerned with. So our mandate is dual. While we grow the sector, we have to grow it from a transformation perspective. The National Development Plan, which others have also referred to before me, is also very instructive in terms of where agriculture is viewed as an economic sector and what role it can play. It views agriculture as central in achieving inclusivity and the socio-economic goals of the NDP. Again, you come to the rapid transfer of agricultural land to historically disadvantaged individuals, capacity development, and the issue of partnerships to enable established farmers to participate in land reform features very prominently. Better land use in communal areas, again, to improve livelihoods, and the numbers we are all familiar with in terms of the National Development Plan. But the central point is agriculture, and therefore, by extension, the land bank has a central role to play in this regard. It is therefore not a surprise that the contribution from AFASA touched repeatedly on the work of the land bank, because this is exactly at the core of what we do. And I promise to return the favor to Dr. Mahlathi. Several speakers earlier have touched on constitution, the section, the applicable section 25, the preamble to the constitution, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this in the interest of time. Of course, as the Land and Agricultural Development Bank of South Africa, our focus is on agricultural land, and perhaps that's where I'm going to be spending more time. But I think, as Professor Hall said earlier, it's important for us to understand that we don't have a single land question. We have multiple land questions, and we need, in the end, to address the different land questions that we have with. Again, the benefit of being at the tail end, is that some of the points that I want to refer to have already been touched on, but the slow pace of redistribution has already been covered earlier, and the amount of resources that have already been directed at the land reform program so far, I think has already been highlighted. And we have also heard that so far we do not have a very good story to tell in terms of the outcomes of our land reform program, and therefore we need to start thinking differently. But to before we get there, I think it's also important that I just to remind everybody that the institution that is the land bank is an old institution. Everybody knows the land bank was established back in 1912, and at the time it was established exclusively for white farmers. So you will recall that if we skip and fast forward to the amended 2002 Act, we started seeing a more emphasis, as I have demonstrated earlier, now on transformation from the same institution. And so it's a constant source of complaint, understandably, from various quarters, to say, why is the land bank, you know, not playing its transformative role? It's operating just like another commercial bank, and that is true, because that's where the bank is. The land bank is expected to go to the same debt markets that the commercial banks go to. It gets no allocations from government. And the investors to the land bank have a certain set of expectations in terms of how their money is going to be invested. And they don't play around when it comes to those covenants that the land bank is made to commit against. And so in some cases, actually, the land bank even gets its funding at more expensive rates than the commercial banks, because it's considered riskier than the other commercial banks because of the space that we play in. So the question is always then, which funding do we then give to the startups, the emerging farmers, those that have not been part of this decades of getting experience, etc. And so it is a question that if this land reform program, the renewed energy that we are putting into discussions on land reform, needs to be brought to the fore. The issue of how do we, from a financial perspective, use some of the already available institutions and frameworks and infrastructures as the government of South Africa for optimal benefit is going to be crucial. So with the revised mandate as outlined in the amended Act, the bank's strategic development objectives cover those areas: the transformation area, growth of the sector, employment quality, food security — everybody has touched on that — sustainable development. And this is now one of the areas where a little bit more energy is now being directed in terms of environmental and social sustainability of the enterprises that that are being funded. Again, if you think about these things, again, it's easier for the established commercial farmers to comply with this, because some of our funding now, especially from multilateral organizations like the World Bank and other development agencies, has some covenants that say we will only lend where we have, we can be able to get commitment from an environmental and social sustainability perspective. And the emerging farmers are struggling to meet this. So again, they are going to miss out on these opportunities unless we change the way we do things as government. The National Development Plan has provided us with a kind of a direction in terms of some of the commodities. I think it was Dr. Mahlathi who was talking about a commodity approach. This is part of what we think carries a lot of potential for the sustainability and competitiveness of the agricultural sector, which can be a model that can benefit the land reform program as well, because you can start developing these enterprises, developing areas, developing regions and zones around specific commodities that have a high growth potential and that can contribute to the economy, but also can absorb a lot of labor. And so this is the focus for us. And as we work with some of the emerging entities now to see how we can be able to accelerate the focus on some of those commodities. So like I said earlier, this is one of the critical issues at the bank, the funding model. From a commercial funding perspective, it's the same commercial debt, commercial debt that you get like the commercial banks with all sorts of financial covenants, including your non-performing loan ratios, your cost-to-income, capital adequacy, etc., etc. And these are fund managers like you know, like any of the commercial banks and some of the commercial banks themselves. And that's where the challenge is. And then on the other side, even where we are able to mobilize some of the development funding from institutions such as the World Bank, as I said earlier, where the emphasis is on development impact. Now there are additional requirements from an environmental and social sustainability perspective, which is difficult to meet for some of the new entrants to the farming space. So typically, you would have, for an established farmer, which is what we have labeled here, farm A on the left, you would have a solid track record, you would have equity capital, you would have access to markets, you would have the know-how, the skills, etc., you would have risk cover and asset cover. And you'd find that now you have to finance this other farmer on the other side who has none of these elements. And so how do we then, to support the effort of land reform, bring this other side to the same level, reduce the risk to the same level where we can be able to apply the same funding that you get from the commercial space to this farm. So there are a lot of options that we are exploring in order to lower the risk, to enhance the business case and bring those to bankability, and lowering some of the standards that are normally expected for a farm of that nature. I don't know how much time I still have, but typically, if I can just take a few of those chair apart from a land availability perspective, and I think Dr. Mahlathi mentioned the high prices, especially during the as part of the land reform program. Again, it's the historically disadvantaged individuals that struggling to access land. Our view as the bank is that it is important, land is important, but it's just the beginning. You need to start thinking about other things. This is part of a comprehensive support program. So in our view, most of the focus over the last couple of decades has actually been on transferring land without the requisite support. And that's where land reform has been problematic. And if we start looking at how land is made, access to land can be guaranteed with security of tenure, etc., but then start bringing all the other elements, the planning, the project research and planning element, business plans that are credible, etc., the skills, the know-how, and etc., etc., before you even start talking about bringing in the funding, because you can't start throwing money in that space where you do not have a viable enterprise, which is why we feel that the land bank has actually a very important role to play in the land reform space, because you already have an institution that has systems that are developed in order to assess the viability of agri-enterprises. So why don't you use this existing framework, but put in the resources that are redirected to other entities through an institution that can ensure that in the process of land reform, the beneficiaries, the entities that you are funding are viable enterprises, so that you are able to blend the finance. If you have grant funding, if you have subsidies, those subsidies are blended with debt funding at the right levels. So that is what we are saying. And then you can move on to implementation. So funding is not the first thing. Then you can start talking about technical support for the ongoing operation. Market access, of course, is an important element in this. And then you can start monitoring the progress for each of these entities. And our submission, Chair, is that a major challenge in this whole thing is the lack of synergy. Is that there is no working together between entities of government, departments of government, provinces, as well as the work that we do as the land bank. And we think that there is a lot of value that can be actually harvested if we start working together more. This is just an example, and I think perhaps the colleague from AgriSA mentioned something of a similar nature, where we start thinking about structures that you can use in order to finance some of these new entities, where you have the project that is going to be owned by structures that include individuals, perhaps historically disadvantaged individuals, and you bring in together some of the established operators, but make sure that you have all the departments that need to provide resources into that entity also upfront. And then for funding, insurance, etc., and then access to markets, farm-managed support, management support, as well as making sure that there is sufficient technical support, including capacity development. To close off, Chair, I have just these questions which I think provide us with a few things to think about as we proceed with the land reform program. The first thing is we have a number of lessons that we have harvested from the two decades or so of land reform in this country. We need a system that is going to make sure that we harvest the necessary lessons from that period, and we make sure that we avoid those. The second one is how do we foster alignment within existing government framework for optimal benefit? I've already mentioned that this is our view, that this is one of the main issues that have contributed to the, if I can say, not so good results that we have observed over the last couple of decades. The other thing, Chair, is the qualification criteria for beneficiaries is something that will probably need to be worked on for for this new period. We need to design a beneficiary qualification criteria that ensures that the limited financial resources we have are directed at viable enterprises. We need to leverage private sector resources in the process, and so we need to develop these structures that are going to allow us to tap into that. I think the organized agriculture and the private sector colleagues always say that they are willing to come into the party. So we need to create structures that are going to allow them to be able to do that. The institutional arrangements that are going to govern the redistribution process is going to be one of those that are going to be critical. We need to have a process that everybody can buy into. Everybody knows what the process is about and what it's trying to address, and everybody is fully sold in terms of the final objectives that we are trying to achieve from a redistribution
perspective. At that point, your time has expired.
The final one is, Chair, I think we need to know exactly how we're going to measure ourselves at the end of this process. That is an element so far that I haven't picked up. Where are we going? How are we going to know we have achieved our objective for land reform? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Of course. It is 5:30. At 1:45, I'll remind you, you've got 5 minutes, and at 10:00, I'll stop you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm here representing the National Executive Committee of Contra Lesa, and I've prepared a statement there that will talk to issues of state land transfer to rural communities, as well as the critical point relating to the issue of expropriation without compensation. But first, Chair, we need to take a glance into the historical circumstances when dealing with issues of land, and state land in particular, that was bought and owned by rural communities and their traditional leaders. The repeal of the notorious Land Act of 1913 brought relief to some of those dispossessed of rights in land, but that meant nothing thus far, as the state continued to illegally hold on to rural people's land instead of the state transferring such parcels of land to its original rural communities under traditional leadership. Government has been refusing to transfer our land in title, alleging that there is no legislation to effect such transfers, which it knows that it is irrefutably deceiving us with that account. As Contra Lesa, we understand land reform in the context of distributing land in the hands of the minority into the majority of the South African citizens. The talk of holistic across-the-board approach in attempts to also expropriate land in black hands is unacceptable to us and compromises the objects of land reform as we understand it. And we are not shy of telling all that such a move can only happen in the year 4000, if we still be around. Because by that time we'll be ancestors. That basically tells that it is impossible and will not accept it to happen in our lifetime. Let me inform you before getting into the topical issue that we have been waiting for transfer of all undisputed traditional authorities' land belonging to our communities. That, I think, will knock some sense into what Dr. Tlaisen alleged, that we, the traditional leaders, are the ones who are saying land must be registered in our names. No, that's not the case. We demand that instantaneous transfer and calling on the state to immediately evoke Section 3 and 4 of distribution and transfer of certain state land number 119 of 1993, as well as evoking section 2 and 3 of Land Title Adjustment Act of 111 of 1993, and also to enforce section 3 of Restitution of Land Rights Act, and also apply Article 14 of the Indigenous and Tribal Peoples Convention number 169 of 1989. These are legislation at the disposal of government to use, but that did not happen because transferring land parcels will restore the power to traditional leaders, which the ruling party cannot afford to let it happen. We reached agreement with government in 2017 at Beachwood Hotel in Benoni, wherein an agreement was reached that by December 2017, all state land that communities are occupying should by then be transferred in title to the communities that are residing on those lands. And as Honorable Leva NEC, we need to experience the new dawn that our brand new president is always preaching, and transfer title deed to deserving communities as the entry point. Secondly, another contentious matter is that government is creating communities within communities, and in the process stripping traditional leaders' hold on the traditional systems that defies and identifies them. The new land acquisition by entities such as CPAs that excludes former administrators of the land, being traditional leaders and their entire communities, is a cause for concern. The government does not hesitate to transfer parcels of land to such entities, but fails to recognize traditional authorities as legal entities in taking off ownership of their restored land and land communities are using for beneficial purposes. This impedes the development of such areas and will also render rural economies unattractive destinies for investments, and we cannot have our government having a share of this cramping behavior. Thirdly, Chair, the state nationalized our minerals without compensating communities which own lands where those minerals are mined. The state always says, in terms of the Mining Act, minerals belong to the people. The state is the custodian thereof. By so doing, they were nationalizing minerals, and yet Section 25 of the Constitution was in existence when this act was promulgated. What is the government telling us under these circumstances? Currently, minerals belong to capital holders who are chamber of mines and not us, the rural communities, who stays on those mined lands. We are the real owners and yet deprived of this prized commodity. My national decision makers, please respect the law and let us comply and follow the 2003 Constitutional Court judgment on Richtersveld community land claim. The Ham Musenege ruled that you cannot separate land from minerals, and the owners of the land are also owners of those minerals. Nobody is complying to that. This judgment opened our doors for our arguments to reclaim our stolen minerals. This then calls for the state to expropriate minerals from those who are illegally holding them now, if one consider this Constitutional Court judgment. It is time for rural communities to exercise their right constitutionally and demand their minerals back. The state is illegally holding those mineral rights for them. That calls for all mining licenses in communal land to be revoked in terms of this 2003 judgment and to be handed over to the owners of the land. The rural and economically marginalized poor people in rural communal areas under the system of traditional leadership have to be party to all mining operations and take control of mineral wealth within their areas of jurisdiction. Coming to the current expropriation without compensation debate, which we are struggling to comprehend because its meaning in terms of the Queen's language means a forced sale, of which a sale is a transaction between two parties. I'm not sure whether I'm debating now, what I'm debating now, and wish to don't wish to be miseducated. The parliamentarians modestly chose nice words instead of just calling this exercise dispossession of wild right in land and repossession of stolen precious asset. We maintain that calling the process repossession will make a lot of sense in our context. It is understandable, though, because of late international outcries and concerns take precedence over local and historical injustices perpetrated on defenseless blacks on their land. Notwithstanding the named technicalities, Contra Lesser is of the view that expropriation has been there all along in terms of Section 25 of the Constitution, as well as Section 42 of Restitution of Land Rights Act of 1994, and the government never bothered to test using this legislation. The Land Claims Commission nationally failed us and must either be reconfigured or done away with, because they were legislatively armed and had everything within their powers to implement this legislation and expropriate land, but chickened out every time the opportunity presented itself. We cannot applaud government as if it has now come up with the ultimate missing link in the land reform process. It failed to implement what was there and cost us dearly in the process. We, however, support retaining of our people's land through the current expropriation without compensation initiative, and we are of the view that all the land that was previously acquired without spending a cent by initial white owners. We agree reparation is not only fair, but justifiable and necessary. We, however, support you with conditions, and that has to wholly be land in white hands and not the ones in black hands. The expropriation must solely be for the 87% of land in minority hands. Anything to the contrary will invite our hostile responses, traditional leaders. Furthermore, we don't want this expropriation to be implemented in the proposed manner of state taking ownership of expropriated land. The state never owned land and must desist from further theft of our community's land by pretending to be a conduit in finally transferring black communities' land to the disenfranchised masses of South Africa. The state took ownership of our land after expropriating it in 1993 and 1994, when they transferred land within homelands and TVBC states to it using abolition of homelands, where all parcels of land under communal occupation were declared state-owned as a result. The Expropriation Act of 1975 informed expropriation at that time, and a critical question is who was compensated when they expropriated tribal land in 1994? Who was paid and how much? Because rural people under traditional leaders owned that land, and not the apartheid regime, not the TVBB states, and not the homelands. We don't want the state to repeat that legalized theft this time around, unless it wants to tempt us to demand compensation in terms of Expropriation Act of 1975 for expropriated properties. One discord in this proper expropriation debacle is the attached conditions, as Contra Lesser, we view it as a biased attempt, because President Ramaphosa said food security must not be compromised or tampered with during the implementation of expropriation without compensation. That literally means Schumann's oranges in Kroalatau or the two tomatoes in Mubani cannot be expropriated because they bring in foreign revenue and provide food security. Whose interest will this expropriation then serve? What will happen to those poor people who are dispossessed of rights in land and those properties not be touched? If these affected portions of land cannot be restored to their rightful owners, we are then wasting our time in trying to make sense out of these expropriation consultations. It has to be implemented holistically without consideration of external variables. Otherwise, it will be a farce.
5 minutes.
Okay. Let me shoot straight to what we recommend as Contralesa. We are cognizant of the fact that there are easy and simple retorts to our demands at the government disposal, and yet the solutions seem a distant future or almost non-existent in the eyes of those in government and in power. The undeniable fact is that there must be immediate transfer of undisputed and bought tribal communities' land to their deserving communities, as the state cannot continue to hold on to the rural communities' land illegally, as the 1913 Native Land Act that entitled them to hold our land in trust for us has been scrapped. This can be done by a stroke of a pen, and the process must be completed before the dawn of 2019. This one is non-negotiable because previous arrangements with the relevant authorities to this effect brought unfulfilled promises. Secondly, political will is needed now to craft congruence and downrightly address pertinent land issues. What we detected over time is political repressive conduct disguised to be a good-mannered approach to resolving our trepidations in tackling genuine concerns raised by traditional leaders pertaining to land. We demand reconsideration of previously tribal land that is currently transferred to CPAs and cessation of transfer of tribal land to CPAs after successful land claim process going forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Hosh. Honourable members, we've had 5 presentations, and just me alone, I'll spend 3 days on these presentations if I had to respond to them, but I'm sure all of you would. So I'm proposing that all of us will be afforded only 2 questions. Please prioritize. There's 10 of us. If we ask 2 questions each, there's 20 questions. And remember, these are about sharpening. It's not about debating the views of those that made presentations. So I'm suggesting, or I'm seeking your wisdom, would it be okay if we limited each member to 2 questions and take it from there? So you'll decide which 2 are the most pressing from everybody that has spoken. If that's okay, can we go that route? Is that okay? Oh, happiness? Okay. Yabama. If it's happiness, let's start, as I warned you earlier on, we start to decide. We'll start with you, Swartz, come to Paulson and do the rounds. Only 2 questions, and you'll indicate who you're asking. Please take note, and you'll be afforded an opportunity to respond. Hold on. Before you start, Honorable Swartz, Honorable Paulson.
Chairperson, may I make a suggestion that if we have any other questions, that we actually be allowed to submit those questions in writing. Thank you.
All right. We will, if you do it via a PET, so that there's a coordinated approach, we will send it to the author, and then in. I want to remind everybody that this is not the end of the road. There are still public hearings. So we'll still call all of them and interrogate them at the public hearing. So this was just to sharpen us. So, but we'll expect some written questions in the meantime. And if it's covered in your main proposal, you can just say that. That, look, it's covered in our main proposal, and when you come for your for your oral, then we can take it from there. But let's start with the Honourable Swartz. Two questions.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentations. I found them very useful. Hoshi Pashla, I just wanted to start with you at the end, and I just wanted to ask you the attempts that you have made, and it's actually disgraceful from our side that those parcels of land has not been referred to the traditional rural communities under traditional leadership. And I'd like you also to comment on the findings on the Ingonyama Trust that has also come out in terms of the high level panel. So that is my one question to you. And then to Agri South Africa and to Dr. Mishlati and to the Land Bank, it will be one question. Ek net vir Agri South Africa baie dankie sê vir jou inset. Ek waardeer ook die feit dat jy die 1913 grondwet gelees het. Dalk moet alle Suid-Afrikaners daai wetgewing lees. We should read that 1913 Land Act to understand the impact of what happened. And so I would ask you just your consideration. My biggest concern is the fact that if we have expropriation with or without compensation, as my view is in terms of the present Section 25, the problem at the moment is state custodianship with land. The traditional leader, Hoshi Pashla, indicated his concerns in that regard, and it seems that there is a move towards state custodianship, and can we as MPs look considering this, given the fact that we had state capture last year? Can we trust the executive in this regard? And Dr. Mishlati, you indicated, both of you, the problem with security of tenure, that's not releasing funds. So how can we assist in that regard? And that will be an encompassing concern, where you've got leases and you don't have capital being released, and that was all three of you indicated a problem in that regard.
Oh, well, I'm cheering you. You're fine. You're fine. If you get out of order, I'll stop you. No, don't worry about the moment. Honourable Paulson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentations, those that I had the privilege of seeing. I want to ask Dr. Lita Magpinka. The first question is, you said that there's a poor experience of poor outcomes for emerging farmers who are struggling. So I'd like to know, firsthand, I would imagine it's a combination of both equipment, skills, financial, in other words, and what happens to these farmers, these emerging farmers, after you consider them as to having failed, and obviously through no cause of their own, because you can't just go and farm and you're not given the proper equipment, and you also may not have the correct skills. So what happens to those farmers? And then the next question is to Mr. Hosi and Fala. I can understand that you have a concern about the state being the custodian and administering the redistribution of that land. But isn't there a way that traditional leaders can be part of ensuring that that is done fairly? And what would it require for traditional leaders to appreciate the sole custodianship of the land by the state? But then also, you said that we should go with this aid with this land expropriation without compensation. I hope you were serious that when you said there'll be some hostile responses from traditional leaders. I mean, we live in a very violent country. There's murders all day long, and I'm very concerned if a man who has so much influence and authority makes a threat of hostile response. Because it's a deep concern for any peace-loving citizen if someone who has the authority and the influence, makes such a statement of a hostile response, because whether we like it or not, land expropriation without compensation is going to happen. Whether it's Ingonyama Trust or whichever trust, we're going to expropriate the land and revert to sole custodianship of the state. So I'm asking you, how is it that you can work with the state as opposed to coming up with an alternative of threats and that sort of thing? Thank you very much.
No, I can hear what you're saying on the
spot. It's not a given.
I know, yes, I knew you were going to say that. I don't want us to...
You need to call people to order. It's not a given, Chair.
I was going to chair it. I will ask for your assistance, all of you, when I need your assistance. No, so it's fine, Paul. It's fine. Yes, it's fine. Yes. I was going to address that. What is a given is that there will be expropriation without compensation. That is given. Not who the custodian will be once it's expropriated. So let's and that will be a debate that we will have when we go to plenary. So that the record is straight for everybody. And I'm appealing to all of us, because remember I indicated ours is to facilitate. I just want us to ask questions of clarity. We will have our opportunity to debate even their views. Even their views will have an opportunity to debate when our time comes in September. So I hear what you're saying, Honourable Singh and Honourable Paulson. All of us, we're all on the same side. Baba. Non-Singh, always say Singh. Swartz, I beg your pardon. I beg your pardon, sir. Chief, two questions. No, we'll come to you. Two.
No, thank you very much, Chair. Thank you so much. Indeed, the land question is historic and emotive. But I just want to go to the financial institutions, where I can see that there is a fear of unknown when you touch the land questions. It will be a class and a gender area that I'll be dwelling in. Stemming from 1912, where the land bank was...
Sorry, I don't want to be rude to you. Whilst you've got two questions, you've also got 2 minutes.
Oh,
don't give us a preamble and a thesis. Yeah. Two questions, no, 2 minutes.
No, thank you very much. Thanks, sir. Thank you so much. The question to the financial institutions, what is it that make it to be a fearful saying that it will even lead to the downgrading when we expropriate without compensation? Thank you.
You got one more, sir? You just want one? You've got two questions to ask. No? He's asked two. He's only asked one. He only wants one. It's fine. We'll come to you. Let's come to Ngwane.
thank you, Chair. Actually, both the Honourable Sfago and Honourable Swart, they've covered me, my questions. I can just emphasize to Undavizita from Kontralesa on the issue of the ownership in communal land, noting what the former President Mthande said during the high panel, that it's only the traditional leaders of the Eastern Cape who are not the owners of the land, who understands that people should own the land. The rest of the traditional leaders are owning the land themselves on behalf of, he just said they are owning the land. You can just emphasize on those remarks, also touching on the issue of Ingonyama Trust as well, your opinion. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And then let's go to Pietman.
So thank you, Chairperson. Thank you also for the presentations. Two quick questions. The one is to the lending institutions. If the commercial requirements is a hindrance, as indicated by the Banking Association and the Land Bank, what international examples is available in terms of other vehicles to give support to emerging farmers, and especially the Brazilian model? Can we maybe have more details? Then to the organized agriculture. In the NDP, it's indicated that at local level, there must be committees formed, like we have in the Witzenberg and other areas. Now, how many of these local committees currently operating in the 9 provinces of giving expertise but also leadership in ensuring that the land distribution process is facilitated. What is the current picture? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Kornoff.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be quick. First one to Agri South Africa. If I've missed it, please correct me. What is your solution in terms of land tenure for laborers on farms? Do you have any solution on how to deal with that? Land tenure for laborers. And then to Basa. You know, obviously, I think it was slide 7 where you say if we're going to do expropriation without compensation. But, you know, my feeling is you have projected your results on that it is going to be a land grab. So you say what will happen, you know, with investments and what will happen with banks and, you know, with regard to that. Can I just ask, you know, are you not overreacting when we're talking about expropriation with compensation? Obviously, if you've been here this morning, there is parameters with regard to this.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Only two questions. The first one, Agri-SA and AFASA, in relation to food security. Agri-SA made mention of resolution of the ruling party in terms of food security and economic growth. But AFASA went on to unpack it and emphasize it in terms of inclusivity. So your comment in that, and again, the issue of plethora of policies and non-implementation thereof. The 2013, by 2035, you said there will be 66.9 million population. So you emphasize on food security, but the issue of land in terms of especially our most vulnerable, the poor of the poorest, the black majority. No mention was made about that. Your comment. And then to Khoshi Matapohol, maybe share with us the issue of customary law rights in relation to communal land. The role communities, let's hope I'm not too fast, Khoshi, the role which communities play when coming to development in the rural areas, and the role the institution of, not a traditional leader, because traditional leadership is an institution, and then the role the traditional council as a structure play in that role. Thank you so much, because people are confusing issues here. Thank you.
Yeah, I couldn't even let the lane. First, you came and you put the oil on the water here, but we welcome. We are welcome. Chief Chair, anything from your side?
No.
No. All right. Can I ask my chief? Okay, my first one is with the banking institutions, both of you. You know, and this is my understanding, both of you focused on the fact that it is risky business to do business with people who don't have assets, because you referred to the assets and so on. I don't understand how you ever hope to transform, because those people that we want to give the land to are inherently high risk. So this argument of profit motive, or it is emphasized by your loan book being 90% white. It emphasizes the very matter that you're raising, that your loan book land bank is 90% white. And I'm just taking what your colleagues have said, because that just goes against everything that's transformation. So that's my first question, that somehow you guys have to forget about profit and think about transformation. It's just a question. The second one that I would want to raise, you know, Agri South Africa, and again, I guess it overlaps with certainly the bank.
Because both of you are saying expropriation will tamper with the market, the free market and so on. There's always been an argument that the market is such that we were not able to afford as government to acquire land. This willing buyer, willing seller type of story. Now, do you think that if we don't expropriate without compensation, the market will ever come and be nice to us? I'm asking it in light of the fact that L.V. Sachs and others had said we should expropriate with a, I don't know, they call it a nominal figure or something, 1 rand or 0 rand. So that's the one argument that says, you know, that's what we should be looking at. I'm getting the sense that the banks and Agri are saying if you expropriate without compensation, the markets will go into a wheelspin, we will be downgraded, and we'll have nothing left of this country. So the question is, how do we marry these two? Because, let me repeat, there will be expropriation without compensation. There will be it. What we are trying to understand here is, how do we do it so that we allay your fears, sir, which are genuine, allay the bank's fears, allay everybody's fears. But the fact that we're going to expropriate without compensation, I think is a given. It's just, how do we do it? Do we do it via the free market, or do we do it via the nominal figure that those that spoke this morning spoke about? Because it's about sharing the land. 73% of the country can't own, or 73% of the land can't be owned by a certain sector. Those are the hard questions that you guys must answer for us. Thank you very much. We're also going to ask you, I don't know, maybe we'll do the same thing with all of you. Let's just do that so that you have a closing argument, because some will say, but we'll not ask questions. So we're going to allow everybody that represented this afternoon just to give you a closing arguments on the basis of what we've said. Because I want to remind you, yours are to sharpen our attitude. If you want to answer specifically, it's fine. If you want to answer globally, but you all have closing statements. Can we start right at the back with Land Bank? Yeah? And then we'll come to to the banking institution, Horsey, up and down in their fashion.
Jake, how much time are you going to give them each? And they can amplify and write in as well, possibly.
Correct, yeah.
How much time?
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, I'm sorry that I'm counting, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, we have about 8 of you. Can we give you a maximum of 2 minutes each? All right? And you'll amplify in writing if you want. Is that okay? Closing remarks, Bob.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. I think the first thing is about the state being or maintaining the custodianship of agricultural land. We don't think that is where we should go. Absolutely not. We would like to see as much of that land that has been acquired by state as being put into production with the necessary tenure structures in order to facilitate that land maintaining its value as much as possible. So that's where we stand. So we don't support that. The second, I think, question, which I think you touched on, and several other, I think, members, similarly, it's about the first thing, and the chair at the end mentioned it, to say you have this loan book that is largely white, and the other question was, what then? What do you do? I think from the honourable member from the EFF, etc., etc. But it's about the same thing, right? And I think in order to respond to that, the first thing to say is, we as an institution are actually very excited this conversation is starting up now, because I think it's a good time to really rethink what exactly is the objective of having an institution such as the Land Bank, because we think this is a conversation that's been missing. Everybody has just had expectations of what the bank should do without talking exactly about what this institution is supposed to be doing and what sort of framework, support framework around it should exist. As any development finance institution, the expectation for a development finance institution is that you should use your capital to impact the sector that you're working in over time, and then there should be time at which the state is looking at how you are constantly being supported in terms of the capital that is expected to decline over time, because then you are using your capital to impact the sector where you are playing positively. That goes without saying. So we would like to have that conversation. The final thing is, of course, we have now, in the meantime, while this hasn't changed, and this will also respond to what then are we doing with this farmer. Most of the work that we are doing recently has been bringing the co-ops on board to work directly with them. We have about 8 service level agreements with different co-ops who then get to manage these direct relationships with our farmers. We have concluded also several other deals that work with developing farmers. One example is the one with TSB Sugar in Mpumalanga, where we give them our funding on a wholesale basis, and then they have a direct relationship with the farmers, and they have it also makes sure that the farmers have a guaranteed market access for the produce that's coming from their production activities. The last example is an example we have with the horticulture industry, for instance. It reduces some of the requirements that we would normally need as a financial institution by making sure that the industry body, the horticulture industry, leveraging funding from the jobs fund, from the horticulture industry, and combining that with debt funding from the land bank, we were able to put together a fund to the value of 600 million that can be accessed only by developing farmers, so that they are able to develop to the level that we are looking at building them to. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Fenter.
Chair, let me start with your questions. I absolutely agree that there is a need for the financial sector to deepen its penetration, especially into the smallholder and emerging farmer environment. And that's why we've been engaging with the Department of Agriculture for the past year, where we're trying to create a model which is a value chain approach, where you mitigate the risks through that value chain, including access to market, the need for climate, drought, flood, risk insurance, and so on, to where you can actually make them commercially viable. What is very important is that it is premised on a partnership where both parties actually carry that risk, and that risk is mitigated to acceptable levels. So we are 100% behind that. It's about how do we unpack that, and our hope is that this debate now is actually going to lead into this thing where we start looking critically at that post-settlement support, which has been a big vacuum for the last 20-something years, and access to market. And the other thing that hasn't been touched on, and it's critically important for a lot of emerging farmers, is infrastructure. The lack of infrastructure in those areas to allow them to get that access to market. So I think one needs to look at it holistically, and we're very keen to actually engage in that debate. Your second question is around expropriation will happen. We acknowledge that. We understand that. You know, if you look at what we're actually saying, we think that Section 25 actually caters for expropriation without compensation in certain instances. It's how one actually manages that you don't undermine market confidence, where your
neighbor starts saying, well, am I next? Because it's when that negative perception sets in that you actually have perceptions actually driving the market array. It's a balancing act. It's a delicate balancing act, and I think it's going to be very difficult for this committee to actually get that balancing act and that confidence in place. And I think what is very important is your farming community has sat with policy uncertainty for over 20 years. We can't perpetuate that for the next 20 years or heighten that uncertainty. Somehow, whatever you decide, you need to it's got to be quick, and it's got to be create certainty in the market, and it's got to be very focused and balanced too. There was a second question about, are we not overreacting? In our bigger submission, we've actually created different scenarios. We've just now taken this one where expropriation without compensation would be across the board, and looked at that impact. But there are different scenarios, and certainly the depth and the breadth and the manner in which expropriation without compensation happens will obviously change all that. So I'd certainly take that point. Chair, one more question. So what did the Brazilians do from a state perspective? Government got involved, and that partnership, they created things like credit notes, where your emerging farmers were either able to get cash so that they could actually go and buy seed and fertilizer and stuff like that. It was traded in the market. It was the active involvement of government in actually creating an enabled environment for those emerging farmers to flourish in. And there are other countries that can do the same. One last question that was asked is, so why are we scared about South Africa getting into a junk bond status? I think, so to understand it, there are a couple of countries in Southern America that are there. It typically takes anywhere between 2 and 20 years, sometimes longer, to get out of that. It's epitomized by a period of stagnation and economic recession. In that cycle, what happens? Economic growth goes for a loop, it's negative. Your currency depreciates, your unemployment levels increase. You know, the 2008 global downturn, it actually cost us just over 500,000 formal jobs in our economy, as a by way of example. Inflation increases, interest rate increases, food insecurity increases. Those are all things that we cannot, as a country, we cannot afford it. We've got just over 25% of our population currently unemployed, and almost 25% suffering from food insecurity.
Thank you, sir. We'll give you an opportunity to exhale, certainly in the next month or two, on all these items. 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Chair. There were two similar questions asked by two members of the committee that talks to the high-level panel recommendations. We know that there are some rotten apples within us, and that should not be a general view that all traditional leaders behave in that manner. There are few instances where traditional leaders do what is not expected of them in terms of traditional law and customs, where in most instances they will dictate terms in terms of land administration and registration. We are well aware of that. But the general rule in terms of customary law is that we are there because of those communities, and we are non-existent without them. So whatever land that needs to be registered, it has to be in the name of the communities, not us specifically, the traditional leaders. So whoever came out with us, that perception that we are all greedy individuals who wants the land to be registered in our names, I don't know where he got that idea from. Because we register that land in the name of the communities, and we are just the custodians and administrators of that land in consultation with whatever council that will be in place. There's one disturbing factor concerning that panel recommendations in relation to the Ingwenyama Trust. I don't believe things are done the correct way in terms of that trust, but that doesn't cause for expropriation of that Ingwenyama Trust land. It only needs transformation. That's all it needs, so that everybody should have a stake in the land that he resides or historically owning. Not necessarily that you need to expropriate that land so that you could do whatever you want to do just to punish the king or whatever. What we insist is that there is a need for transformation of the Ingonyama Trust, not expropriating that land. The second question, I think, relates to why are we approaching a hostile attitude in dealing with this issue of land? There were consultations across the country, but I don't remember a single incident where our structures were called in to be participants in those consultations. They were conducted somewhere in towns and cities far away from the rural people, and they'll just take a country boy in town and ask him questions and make comments based on what Dr. Klassen once published. And that the commission viewed that as an input from traditional communities. That is wrong. They should have come to us, let them hear what we say about this whole thing, and then make an informed recommendation based on what how we responded. There is a classical example asked by my committee member here that why is it only Eastern Cape that is doing things the right way? No, it's not. All the other provinces are doing things the right way. Maybe in Eastern Cape they managed to get hold of the traditional leaders to a consultation session. But I've never heard of any meeting that was called for traditional leaders in Limpopo to say, can you come over and then talk about this thing? Never. Then where did they get that recommendation from? The perceptions that are there are killing our institutions and polarizing our communities from traditional leaders, and they are very dangerous. That is why we say, if there is no consultation, then we will meet, we will respond to it the way we want it to reach the next person in the fastest way that it can. And the only way is to be hostile to the process that we are not party thereof, which involves us.
No, you're right, of course. CS, on the 26th of June, we'll be there by you. So CS, in our, we will consult every South African.
I've learned that in Kroos that there will be...
We'll come to you, so we'll afford you that opportunity. I'll manage, simply because if you want...
No, I'll be there. The last question, I think, was from Hotshira Dimutab, as to... maybe people do not understand how the council functions. So I want to... Please don't stop me.
Otherwise, you'll be accused of preferential treatment. No, Coach, I don't want preferential treatment.
This is critical.
I know it's critical. But can I give you a minute? Because I
Okay. The most democratic system you can ever have in a traditional governance system is the one that we practice. Because the councils are comprised of heads of all the clans that are there within a particular community, which will come to the council meetings representing views of all the households under their leadership. So whatever decisions that are taken there are binding, and there's no leader, myself as a traditional leader, that I can go against a decision that was made by a traditional council. So people are confusing traditional council and a royal council. A royal council is just a comprise of few people that are related to the Hoshi and the royal house. But the decision makers are the traditional councils, and there's no one who can ever go against them. So that confusion is spreading false information about how the functioning of the traditional council do its business. And I want to put it on record that we are the most democratic system that you can ever find in a traditional setup, because we rely on the majority decisions that are taken by relevant people representing their constituencies.
I know, amen, sir. Thank you, Chair. I would like to respond to the question about the district land committees. District land committees, as we all know, were set up in terms of the National Development Plan.
The idea was that they'd be very actively involved at ground level with land reform. There would be farmer involvement, there would be bank involvement, there would be cooperative involvement, and there would be training institution involvement. They would then select the beneficiaries and monitor the actual the land reform process as it was happening on the ground. Throughout the country, district land committees were then set up. They had their teeth pulled. They were given no decision-making powers. They turned into talk shops. The decisions that they did take were disregarded. All the decisions were taken by the department. So the result is actually, yes, there are district land committees, but every single one of them is malfunctional. Thank you.
Just to build on that one, this is one area, actually, if I were to say that we, as the farming organization, agree upon in terms of an approach. But unfortunately, what we're needing to do, I mean, is to get it right. One of the problems around this is the fact that there is no conceptual frame that drives the activities of the people who are there. What happens is that the members are drawn from the various parties. Actually, they're very good at making sure that all the farmers' unions are represented. But part of the issue is that the people are not even properly trained. And when they get there, there's no strategic approach in terms of what you are actually focusing on from a land reform perspective and even from an agricultural perspective. So we've dealt as a FASA directly with the department and are working on that. But I would like to propose for this meeting, I happen to be also a member of the National Planning Commission. One of the critical things that are needed is the National Spatial Development Framework. And the National Spatial Development Framework is critical for both urban and rural land, and especially in terms of what we're talking about today. We don't have it within the country. And it is important that the politicians, I mean the parliamentarians, push that to move forward quickly. The second thing is the question around the title deed. There is absolutely no way that in this system you can work and be part of the economy without having title, with a title deed that you can gear. And it's very difficult. And I think that one of the things that we're all pushing for is to make sure that we sort that out. But it is also very important that our banking institutions understand by not giving the majority of the people the chance to be part of the economy, a finance system, is actually reducing them into junk status. So if we are talking about junk status, we need to understand that on a daily basis, the credit committees are creating a junk status in this country. So I think that once we begin to look at it in that way, and lastly, is the issue of the delivery system. The whole, at the center of the failure is the governance system and the government delivery system. The delivery mechanism that we have has actually failed us across the board because it focuses us on pilots and fails to upscale across the board. And what we're needing to do now, and particularly from a parliamentary perspective, is to insist that, you know, people don't show one case and to another case, because we're dealing with a major problem of poverty and inequality. So from our side, we believe that the solutions that different people are bringing and that are to be considered as part of the EWC process has to specifically ensure that there's effectiveness around the delivery system, because the problem of not trusting governments is going to be a problem that we cannot totally solve, because to a greater extent, government has to play a role. And, you know, the issue is to focus on the effectiveness and the efficiency of government. You can't rule out government in a sea of poverty, because people would need some level of custodianship at the level of government. But the issue is, how do we make sure that we improve that efficiency?
Ma'am, are you covered?
Chair, does that mean I get her 2 minutes as well?
I only took a chance there.
Chair, first of all, your question, are we not overreacting? I think... Sorry. Chair, now, I don't think we've been overreacting, and AgriSA's response all of this time has been measured. I have not put in the slide where the South African economy goes down the drain, because I said I don't believe we are going to go that way. The problem, Chair, or not the problem, when somebody like yourself says expropriation of without compensation will happen, what happens is that you send the signal into the marketplace, and it makes people extremely nervous. And we argue that the current constitution allows for that. So the constitutional court, and I trust the judges of the constitutional court, can look at it case by case and say, in this instance, we will handle it like this. But when you say it will happen, it sends a signal to the marketplace. The president, Ramaphosa, is calling for investment. We need policy certainty, and that is why I said, the constitution allows for it already, and I think those are the balances that we need to. So no, we're not alarmist. The market still functions according to the land audit. I did not say that is the only way. We said in the 25 of the constitution must be tested. So I'm with you on that one. The inclusive, the members left the room. Our whole plan revolves around land reform, and it includes then inclusive growth. So my children, and hopefully everybody else's children here, will farm in a South Africa where black South Africans consist a far greater proportion of who produce the food and share in the economy of this country. That is what we're all working for, is how we get there. Farm labourers, yes. We do, and the partnership model, there are various forms of the partnership model, and some of them end up in the farm workers owning the land. And there are farmers doing it on their own accord already, and what we need is certain incentives from government, etc., and you will see many more farmers going that route. If I can get the finance and the favorable conditions, I would like to do such a deal with my farm workers where they in the end own the land. So it's not, it's being done, and we are actually writing up all the best practice models for that. There are various shapes and sizes. State custodianship of land, no, we don't believe in that, because with all due respect, the government department can't farm. We need entrepreneurs, black and white, who can farm. The government's role is to create an enabling environment and let the private sector do the farming. The government has a role. Do we trust the state? Honourable Chair, in our history, you could not trust the National Party. That's why we have a constitution like we have now. The constitution says we're not going to trust the state ever again. Not this one, not the next one, and not the government that comes after that, because we do not take our assurances from the government or the state. We take it from the constitution. And the Constitution protects our civil liberties that we now have after our disastrous past. So I hope that clarifies that. And maybe just the last one on the 1913 Land Act, and if you can just give me 1 minute on that one. In the 1913 Land Act, in that period of time, what could white farmers do? They had the land bank. What could black farmers do? They had nothing. What could white farmers do? They could go to a university and an institution of higher learning. What could black farmers do? They couldn't do it. We were hell-bent on segregating South Africa and achieving something that could never be achieved. And there were prolonged periods of time from 1913 up to 1940 where nothing happened. And we are doing the same in our democracy now. There are long periods of time. And somebody one day writes a book about us. They will refer to periods of in our history we didn't do enough. And by the end of 1940, they all of a sudden realized that, you know, you cannot segregate the people of South Africa because they're living and farming amongst each other in any case. So then they made the worst decision that they could ever make, and we went the apartheid route. And the similarities between that time and now is absolutely striking. Last thing, there was an exemption clause in the 1913 Land Act, and nobody speaks about that. About 3,600 farms were actually bought by black people during that time, from 1913 to 1940. In some places they farmed those farms with white farmers, in some places there were partnerships. All of the things that we did not do then, we have the capability to do it now. And we also have the reminder that you do not make the wrong decision again, because then history repeats itself. And that's what the 1913 Land Act and our disastrous history teaches us about that. Every South African should know, I agree, should know that.
Thank you very much. So let me just clarify one point. Remember, let me take you back to the beginning. Our mandate is, does the Constitution need to be amended so that the state can expropriate without compensation? So the argument about expropriation without compensation is a done deal. It's, can it happen with the Constitution in its current form, or does the Constitution need to be amended? And therefore, South Africans, the market, everybody else should accept that this is not stoking any fire. What, in fact, we have been very mature about it. How do we do it so that we maintain stability? That's what we said when we started the meeting. So I just wanted to clear that anybody and everybody that's listening to us understands that when we do it, we will do it responsibly. But it will be irresponsible for us to say that we are still debating whether there is going to be expropriation without compensation in the public interest or whatever. So let's clarify that. It's going to be there. What we're going to do is to regulate how it happens. Does it happen through a constitutional certainty? Does it happen through legislative certainty? I'm hoping that those that are listening to us today understand that that's what we are saying. And no unnecessary panic from any quarter. I was just hoping that gets clarified. You can say the last thing, then I'm going to give it to the chair to fix up. But I don't want to open up another debate on
this. Chair, just to assist you, I think where we are all in consensus is that the present wording of the Constitution does make provision for that. I think that's the clarity that the public will seek, and how then it's going to be further implemented and how the courts will look at just and equitable is a separate issue. But I think there's broad consensus of everyone here that the Constitution, as presently formulated, does. But anyway, let's not open that up.
can he exclude me from his broad consent? Because it's not allowed. I don't know where he studied law, but he can go get a refund.
No, it's fine. The next time we meet, you'll sit here next to me. Che, can we hand over to you to close up?
Colleagues, we gave you black files in a previous meeting where we were trying to help you with the references and some kind of documentation to work from. Today you then decided on a colloquium where we then set out an approach to strengthen what you have in your files in terms of helping ourselves to be in the debate that the whole country is having. We had questions in the morning of the legal questions that were giving us perspective from both law and jurisprudence that is set through court cases. It's not enough, it's a soundbite, but it was substantial. And I think it was helpful and helped us to learn and to really appetized us to go further in preparation for this process. We also got an appetite from the policy questions relating to this Section 25 matter, and we
we now ending and concluding with a perspective. Perspectives from the debates that emanates from the users of land, commercial agricultural users and farmers in emerging in large scale, the banking sector itself, the land bank, and even the traditional leaders who talk, who are also interested in how the communal land question is resolved. So we think that you know, to that extent, the sound bites that we've had today, substantial as they are, they're not sufficient to conclude for us, as you could see now at the end of the just last seconds, where you know, the interpretation on what is a given and what is not given in relation to Section 25. So we do indeed want to thank the presenters who did wonderful work, I think, for in giving us the perspectives and giving us the good questions to this thing. And the consensus for me is that the access to land is not there. People don't have access to land. That's the status quo. And that there is needs for land. And that is the consensus that is there.